Hello and welcome to Navara FM, brought to you by Navara Media and broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM, London's most scintillating of radio stations. I am James Butler. Navara Media is down in Brighton this weekend to cover the Labour Party conference and its fringe event, The World Transformed. Keep an eye on our social media and on our YouTube channel especially to catch live broadcasts every night, including our spectacular Radical Variety show on the Sunday. If you're in Brighton, come on down and join us in the audience for that. You can find tickets online. But just yesterday, I had the immense pleasure of talking to Leah Upi, who teaches political theory at the London School of Economics, and whose writing covers partisanship, citizenship, Marxism, and the political philosophy of the Enlightenment. And one of the great and perhaps very few real boons of our political moment is also that she's been writing with great insight for the national press on our present political crisis. And so we started by talking about just that, about Brexit and about democracy. Because we've seen, obviously, like the way that the kind of political crisis over Brexit has unfolded over the past 3 years has become, you know, it's made kind of really fundamental political issues like live in a way that they haven't been, I think, for a long time in Britain anyway. Like, and not the least of them is democracy itself, like what we mean when we talk about democracy and so on. And obviously one of the things that's been going on in the debates and has been, like, I think, really prominent recently has been this argument about what democracy is, how it functions, you know, the nature of referendum versus representative democracy and the kind of tensions they're in. And maybe even, I don't know what you think about this, maybe even a kind of broader crisis or something kind of underlying this argument, particularly on the right. There seems to be this kind of crisis in the belief of the possibility of representation itself, right? This, which is quite, I think, unusual for the right. And beyond that, there's kind of conflict going on about really fundamental liberal democratic assumptions. So what do you make of the claim that there are these kind of different forms of democracy competing here?
Mm-hmm. So I would say that there's definitely different visions of politics. Mm-hmm. And it's a more difficult question on whether there are actually different versions of democracy. So are there different visions of politics that are being put forward by these various parties to the Brexit debate? Well, yes, there is clearly a kind of radical social democratic alternative, we'd say, in the Labour Party. There is a kind of traditional liberal fudge in the shape of the kind of liberal Lib Dems. And there is also a combination of kind of ultra-liberalism with ethno-nationalism in the current Conservative Party. So I think one of the results of the Brexit debate has been in a way to kind of crystallize these ideological positions vis-a-vis politics. So it's more helpful to think about Brexit as kind of crystallizing the views about politics that these different forces have. And the reason I say it's more difficult when it comes to kind of competing claims for democracy is that we need to ask ourselves, well, what is democracy? What do we mean by democracy? And if you go back to this kind of classical Athenian answer, which is, well, democracy is ruled by the people, then the next question becomes, well, who is the people? What is the people? And there it looks like on the surface we have a kind of answer to the question in the shape of the various, you know, the participants of the kind of Brexit debate. So in a very superficial way, Brexit is about rule by the people and it is about who is the people, and we get different answers to this question depending on the kind of different diagnosis that we give of the relationship between Britain and the EU. And so, for example, in the case of the kind of the Brexit party, the claim of sincere leavers is that the UK is subject to rules that it doesn't really make in a transparent way, that citizens are subjected to the kind of power of European Union institutions, whether in the form of the Court of Justice or in the form of the Commission, and that the way in which we access these decisions is not the kind of way that we would want to have if these decisions were democratically justified. So there is a sense in which we have to go back to the British people, that it's about the will of the people and it's about kind of subjecting these decisions. And then on the other hand, I think the claim of kind of sincere Remainers is also a claim about democracy and the criticism that the Brexiteers, so the Leavers, focus on an excessively narrow way of understanding democracy, which means basically the people who have a British passport. the people is reducible to the people who carry this particular passport, and we don't worry about, for example, the fact that part of the people were also the 3 million EU citizens that were entirely disenfranchised politically from the get-go from this process, and that continue to be disenfranchised and with their lives that are completely at the mercy of these decisions that they have no say and no way of influencing. So, and of course, there's also another parallel argument to that, which is about the importance of transnational democracy. So to the extent that we are subjected to transnational institutions, the people are those that are subjected to these kinds of decisions. And it's important to think about the demos, not in this kind of ethno-national way, but in a broader way, in a way that thinks about the people as all those who are subjected to the decisions of these institutions.
I agree. I think that's a really kind of striking way into the problem. And obviously, one is immediately confronted, of course, with the immediate political question, which is, of course, in any event of a second referendum, you're going to have like major consent problems if you recognise this problem and attempt to bring in a kind of different demos into the you know, people who are permitted to vote on this question. And there's surely going to be a huge conflict over this stuff coming down the road.
Yeah, this is why, in a way, I think that it only looks like it's superficially a debate about democracy, because in the end, when you look at the particularities of the debate, it's never about, well, let's rethink how we think about the people. Let's rethink about who gets to make decisions and how the current political institutions that we have disenfranchise particular categories of people, how they disenfranchise migrants, how they disenfranchise long-term residents, and so on. So it's only superficially about the will of the people, but with a very narrowly defined understanding of who the people are. And then you get into these debates, well, did the people who voted for Brexit know what they were voting for? Or were they voting for no deal when they were? And this is all, I mean, it's all very plausible, but these are all political decisions that don't really go to the fundamental question of what is the relationship really between democratic decision-making. Exactly, yeah. And also, I mean, partly, I think there is also, they're not really unique to Brexit. I mean, the question of, for example, political elites hijacking the democratic deliberative process in various elections, but that's also the case in national elections. It's not just the case in the referendum. I mean, maybe the referendum is irreversible, and so it's a particularly striking case and with more dramatic implications. But in every election, it's clear that the public debate is in some ways conditioned by the various, by the way in which elites influence, have the capacity to actually influence decision making. And so there is a kind of larger question on whether capitalism and democracy are even compatible, that we're not really asking when we take the parameters of the debate for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that always strikes me about the claims made on the part of, you know, people who believe the referendum was illegitimate because there were lies or there was money involved. Are these people who have come to politics for the first time in 2016?
Right, I mean, exactly.
It's very often the case in you know, in general elections, certainly. Here, as well as elsewhere, I mean, I think there tends to be a British exceptionalism to these arguments, which I think is ill-founded. I suppose the thing that is striking the claims made, especially from the kind of far right of the Tory party and the Brexit party as well, is that there is this kind of attempt at a sort of, and I take your claim that there's and I think it's true, there is no fundamental argument about democracy here, actually. The democracy is taken as something that we know what it is, and it is this, and actually, you know, whatever. I think that's true. But interestingly, it seems to me that the way the claim is made by the hard right of the Tory party, Brexit party, is towards a kind of, you know, ersatz realism, or a kind of demystification, a claim of demystification about the way in which politics operates. And it just seems unusual to me that that's coming from the right, because it's the kind of operation I often associate with the left, right? To say that, okay, that, well, the way in which politics operates is limited by these external factors. There are things that aren't permitted to be considered in political debate. So, for instance, liberal democracy often presents itself as a meeting of equals, but there are, in fact, these kind of deep structural inequalities which affect the way in which politics happens. That's an uncontroversial claim of the left. It's a demystifying claim. I can't think of, you know, off the top of my head anyway, where there have been kind of similar demystificatory claims on the right. Am I right to see this as an argument being made by the right?
In a way, yes. And I think it's in a way also a result of the fact that historically the left seems to have won the battle of democracy, at least on the surface, right? So that the defense of democracy is coupled with the defense of liberal democratic institutions. And it's, I think, also an expression of the fact that the left, the social democratic left, has eventually had a stake in the state and comes to represent the state. It's not an anti-state force. And so the institutions that we have, this is why conservatism is not just about conserving the institutions that are only shaped by conservatives. They're also about subverting the institutions to the extent that they have been opposed by a radical alternative, political alternative. And so this is why it becomes, because this is why I think conservatism is not just a force of retrieval, but it's a force of kind of a retrieval and resistance to the status quo as shaped by the forces of the left.
So that's intriguing, the structure of conservatism is something that is, I think, increasingly, you know, the theorists, oddly on the left, are thinking about a lot, right? Because, you know, you have this quite unusual, and obviously it's been in the air in the last few weeks, like, what kind of conservative party is this? It's very strange, it's very new. It doesn't seem entirely strange or new to me. It seems not dissimilar to sort of 1979, post-1979 conservative party, you know, with what is, you know, obviously a pretty... You know, it obviously has some kind of political project in mind, even if that appears kind of inchoate. I don't think it's necessarily that distinctive from 1979's political project. So the sense of there being this sort of like Ur-Burkean conservatism, right, which is simply concerned with, you know, antipathy to dogma, you know, merely keeping things as they are, it doesn't seem to me to be the case. Can you think, I mean, are there examples of that kind of, you know, conservatism, the sort of Burkean sort of conservatism that is very distrustful of you know, grand political projects, or that claims to be very distrustful in any of those things? Is that really an operative force in British politics now?
Do you mean distrustive of grand political projects as embedded in the state?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, the idea that there is certainly a kind of reflection right now in this recovery of tradition, right, and history, and the way in which history and tradition are disrupted by radical change, and also by radical change from the outside. So part of the skepticism towards the EU and this kind of transnational institutions is, of course, skepticism about the way in which they operate. But I think it's also kind of cultural skepticism about the alien nature of the institutions. And I think this is perhaps where the difference is between the kind of the right-wing take on Brexit and the left-wing take of Brexit, that the left is not necessarily hostile to the kind of the cultural cosmopolitanism. It's more about the particular kinds of decisions that these transnational institutions make. Whereas I think in the case of the right, what we see crystallized is both hostility to the kinds of decisions they make, but also to the fact that the agent that makes these decisions is a kind of culturally alien agent. And so I think that's where perhaps we see the continuity with the traditional conservatism themes.
You mentioned the kind of the sort of peace that the left has found with liberal institutions, right? Which I think is true. It's something I've been thinking, you know, a good bit about recently. I've been thinking about this week in you know, when thinking about the way in which the Liberal Democrats have taken this sort of very you know, decisive position on revocation. And thinking about, you know, the triumphs or the historical accomplishments of liberalism, you know, the are, I think, undoubted, and the left has, to some extent, made an accommodation with, or made its peace with, you know, and I'm thinking here about freedom from arbitrary power, you know, the history of constitutionalism, you know, the way in which liberalism has accommodated itself to democracy, and in so doing has produced, you know, so some things that are worth guarding and preserving. At the same time, it seems to me, or it seems to me that there has been a conversation, certainly within academic circles, and I think increasingly just in anyone who observes politics on a global scale, that the kind of liberal consensus, the post-war liberal consensus, you call it, might go back further. You might want to talk about, you know, the way in which you have the development of a sort of welfare liberalism through the 20th century. That kind of consensus, you know, it does appear to be in trouble. And I think that is the fundamental problem here. I wonder if you have a sense, because if there's anywhere in the world where liberalism has a real dominant sways within political theory, right? So, and I think here of the sort of legacy of John Rawls, and I think of the way in which political philosophy has largely oriented itself to, unsurprisingly, because liberal institutions are the ones that exist, has oriented itself to that form of thinking. And even so much so that even critics of liberalism tend to articulate their critiques within the language and the kind of assumptions that are fundamental to liberalism. Do you have a sense, as you teach political theory, do you have a sense that what is obviously a crisis for liberal institutions, as they exist in the world, is reflected in the way that people are thinking about these institutions?
That's a very good question. I think probably no is the answer, or the honest answer. At least, no, I don't really see this yet in the kind of majority. There are obviously corners of liberalism and political theory that might, question the relationship between liberalism as institutionalized and liberalism as it's presented in thought, and thinking about the kind of limitations of liberalism, not just as a set of institutions that we see, that we observe, but also as a set of ideas that make these institutions operate. I think the reason this has not been the case, though, is that I think the left has tended to grant to liberalism that liberalism has invented all good things, equality and freedom and, the idea of human, basic human dignity and so on. So I think there is a kind of common heritage of socialism and liberalism in the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And one of the, as I see, sort of in political theory terms, one of the problems with the debate as it's presented right now is that we often assume that liberalism has invented freedom and equality, and we don't really know what socialism, what is a distinctive contribution that socialism has done. Instead of challenging this very idea and saying, look, liberalism and socialism are both products of a particular way of looking at the world, which is the Enlightenment way of looking at the world. And in fact, what liberalism has done is often to pervert and distort particular ideals of equality and freedom by turning them into their opposite. So if you think about the relationship between liberalism and empire, for example, on the one hand, we kind of advocate freedom and equality, but on the other hand, what liberals do as they kind of go around the world and try to civilize the barbarians is actually exterminate everyone. So I think the socialist tradition hasn't been good at kind of challenging that, partly because of perhaps an opposition between liberalism and socialism as though they were entirely radically different ways of even thinking about reason or thinking about fundamental categories, instead of sort of going back and saying, well, look, there is kind of there is a story that one can tell about socialism whereby what socialism is a kind of better version of all the things that liberals care about, like freedom and equality. And it's a kind of universalization of this idea that is more radical than what liberalism has been able to give us. And instead, what we've done is to kind of concede that these ideals come from liberalism. And so then it's a battle between liberal political institutions and liberal ideals. And we say, well, John Rawls, for example, clearly gives us a liberal critique of liberalism. And it becomes all sort of internal instead of confronting these different traditions and kind of comparing them to each other and thinking about historically about liberalism and about why it takes the shape that it takes and what relationship it has to political institutions. So that's from the kind of the political theory angle. And of course, there's also another story about liberal institutions and the way in which the fact that precisely what we were saying earlier, that the contribution that social democracy has made to democracy has meant that social democracy has developed a stake in the state and therefore has to then defend the state with both. And since the state is a kind of mixed bag, you get liberalism and you get socialism and you get other things as well. Then we have to sort of, in defending the state, we're also defending all these other various elements that come together in particular constitutional forms, in particular political and legal structures, with all the problems that that entails, with all the problems of not leaving us the critical space to then interrogate these institutions and to question them fundamentally.
I want to talk a bit, and it grows quite nicely out of that, actually, and the less relationship to institutions and transnational institutions or the nation state. Just pick up an argument in a piece you wrote that's on the LSE site, titled "There Is No Left-Wing Case for Brexit, 21st Century Socialism Requires Transnational Organization." And I think it's a really striking intervention, actually, and I thought it was well timed when there was this kind of upsurge in like strong Lexit narratives, but I think I don't want to kind of try and encapsulate the whole argument myself, so I won't do that. But I think one of the things that's really striking about it is your identification of the way in which exactly in this form socialist arguments have tended towards a relatively, you know, perhaps even just unthought about embrace of sort of civic republican ideas of the nation state. And could you pick that out for us and just say a little about the way that plays out in the attitude to Brexit?
Yeah, and maybe connecting to some of the earlier things we were saying about democracy is a good way to start the discussion. I mean, it seems to me that insofar as we connect Brexit to the problem of democracy, one of the biggest questions that Brexit has raised for the left is, what is the unit of democratic empowerment on the face of pressures from capitalist globalization, assuming that we share a kind of diagnosis of capitalism and assuming that we share some principles and ideals on, you know, what we need to do to develop an alternative to it. And so, and of course, the left struggle against capitalism, as I said earlier, has traditionally been a struggle against exploitation, against kind of exploitation of wage labor. But it has also been very importantly, really important, and this really can't be stressed enough, a struggle for democratization, for opening up the sites of political participation to subjects that were previously excluded by liberal political institutions. These were all the kind of the battle horses of the left: the emancipation of women, the giving votes to people in the colonies, the emancipation of working classes, of those who didn't have any property. So this is why the problem of the state and the role of what we might call civic nationalism within the state is such a fraught problem for the left, because of the role of progressive socialism within the state, the role that the left has played within the state to kind of open up and to democratize the state, to open up these sites of political mobilization. So then the question becomes, insofar as there is a kind of parallel struggle for democracy, which goes hand in hand with the struggle against global exploitation, the left begins to develop a stake in the state. And then the question becomes, well, what purpose does this play in the long term when you put these two fights together, the fight against capitalism and the fight for democracy? And what is the role of civic nationalism within that? And this has historically been a very difficult question, one on which the Second International has torn itself apart on, you know, what do we make of self-determination, for example, of struggles for self-determination? Should we say that struggles for self-determination basically hijack the fight of the working classes, who should be all united across the world and develop and fight against their capitalist exploitation and not ally with progressive bourgeois forces within their states? Or should we instead say, no, the working class needs its own kind of sites of political mobilization, and it needs to consolidate, and it can only consolidate if it has access to institutions. And to have access to institutions, it needs to kind of develop, to have a stake in the state, basically. So I think this is where the tension, and this plays out not just in the kind of, you know, Bernstein Luxembourg debate around revolutionary socialism versus social democracy, where Bernstein was saying, well, clearly socialists have to be good citizens, and Luxembourg was saying, but also in the kind of Lenin-Luxembourg debate around self-determination, for example, where Lenin was saying, well, we have to concede the right of people to self-determination because we need to, the working classes have to have the institutions in which they can develop. And so there was so it wasn't necessarily just reformism versus revolutionary debate. It was a debate within the kind of revolutionary left as well. And I think we see some of the you know, in some form, we see some of these debates now around the question of what should we do with transnational institutions. Should we democratize transnational institutions, but in the awareness that we don't actually hegemonize any of the particular states? So how can you do that if you don't control any of the particular states that are members of these transnational institutions? Or should we instead develop a completely alternative project of exit and consolidate kind of state institutions to some extent with some isolation? It's a very difficult. I think I personally don't know what the answer is in principle to this question in theory. What I usually say and think is that this has to be a question of strategy, and one that is sensitive to the political circumstances at any particular case, and to the kind of political forces in any particular political context. So my view is that there isn't anything either inherently desirable or undesirable about the EU, just like there isn't anything inherently desirable or non-desirable about the liberal state. Both are instruments, both are vehicles of political agency. And I think the answer to what should we do with either of these institutions has to depend on the balance of political forces within them. And so I would say that in a case like Britain, for example, where the project is clearly controlled by the right, where there is a risk of emboldening the far right, given the kind of anti-migrant discourse that accompanies the exit and so on, where this was a project of the Tory party, for the Tory party. I don't really see why the left should kind of jump into this project, since it's not a project that the left controls or wanted or has thought through. And I think it would have been very different in a case like Greece, for example. The answer would have been very different. So my view on this is that you have to kind of be strategic and pragmatic and think about the balance of political forces within any particular context and the kind of viability of socialism within the state or within the EU to answer.
But because, of course, this conclusion is of course possible if you accept the premise, right, which is that there is nothing intrinsically desirable or undesirable about each of those. The pushback, I think, it's not a view I share, in fact, but let me try and kind of encapsulate it. The pushback would be that because of the fundamental difference in the nature of these entities, this kind of, you know, the state or the liberal state on one hand, particularly the British state, which has like a very weird democratic system. It has, you know, quite a weird constitution in which like there's a lot of power accorded to parliament, so on and so on and so on. Versus, you know, a treaty-based international order in which actually the kind of fundamental change, which is obviously the goal of the left, it is much harder. So the question then surely turns on intrinsic capacity and intrinsic desirability. And I think it's a point well made sometimes, right? Because, you know, I accept and I agree that Brexit is a project of the right. I don't think that's arguable if you look at the way it's, you know, it's been pursued concretely on the ground, the way it's turned out, you know, the even just the kind of things that are regarded as being an issue, i.e. migration. You know, those things I think are very hard to turn to advantage to the left. So then the question becomes like whether you accept that and then think there's some advantage possible down the line by leaving. And I'm not sure whether that's particularly true either. But do you see the argument I'm making?
Yeah, I mean, I see the argument. I mean, in principle, my orientation is also internationalist. So I'm trying to kind of be charitable like you to those who articulate this argument. But in terms of, you know, in terms of the strategy and thinking about the left levers often say, which is, well, how are you going to change the treaties if you don't have a kind of simultaneous uprising of various countries? And I often think, well, think about the fall of the Soviet Union. Think about the cascade effects. From one country, you then get cascade effects because the ideology begins to shift and because the balance of forces begins to shift, because the politics starts changing. These phenomena are not isolated from each other. And so it seems to me that it's actually not very difficult. If there is political will in the EU, all you need to do is to... what would the EU be without Germany? Mm-hmm. If you were to change the kind of the whole debate around socialism and around European institutions and around what kind of alternative European project we might want to have, just in Germany and let's say France as well, you'd get an entirely different configuration of the European project, because you can clearly see that there's... within this set of countries, some of them are more important than others. Some of them have wielded more influence, more discursive power, and so on. So I think the argument that you know, we need spontaneity all over the whole European Union, it doesn't stand to actual historical scrutiny, because when we look at how changes happened, often this, as I say, there's this kind of cascade effect where if there is political will, it's not clear why. When there is political will, it goes one way rather than another. And so it seems to me equally optimistic to think, well, in Britain, we will rescue the Brexit project from the right. We will turn Britain into a socialist country. And, you know, and then this will give an example to all other countries out there, and we'll all have an alternative parallel project. It's not that equally delusional, really.
So. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much where I end up as well. I suppose the flip side of this actually as well is something that occurred to me after speaking with Quinn Slobodian, who's an extremely good book on neoliberalism, was just the way in which, like, when institutional change comes about, it's often by sort of tacit derogation, right? So in fact, actually, you know, political practice is often in advance of the way in which it then becomes encoded. And so it doesn't seem to me, you know, completely impossible that might also be the kind of strategy that produces the sort of cascade effect that you're talking about. I wonder also on this stuff about the nation state, right? Because it's a question we come back to. And in some way, the story that you're talking about the sort of left's refusal of... given political categories, right? So given democratic categories or the limitations of political community that kind of are intrinsic to historic liberalism. So property qualification, gender qualification, so on. Those are often struggles that are conducted within the boundaries of a national state for obvious kind of historical reasons. And it seems, you know, increasingly, you know, there was a point as sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, where you had a kind of wave of conversation about, well, actually the nation state's no longer relevant. It's kind of, you know, removed as a historical actor, even as a field in which politics takes place, right? So you have, on the one hand, concern on the left about, you know, large international institutions, less the EU, frankly, than the IMF, WTO, things like that. It does seem to me that the nation state as a space for politics is really very sharply back as well. And so I wonder whether there are, you know, left political projects that re-engage, you know, on the national level that can also kind of speak to that. I just, you know, other than, I think, the inclusion of migrants within your kind of, you know, your thinking about citizenship, right? And so I wonder, you know, is there a sense, I know we've spoken about this before, actually, but the, you know, do you have a sense of the way in which the left can kind of attack that concept of citizenship to expand it and work at the national level?
Yeah, I think the challenge here, as with all other questions about the state, is how to both defend the state and attack it. So, you know, John McDonald has this good in and out the state, basically. And I think that's the so that, and again, the migrant question is a relevant and important one, because precisely what we're at one level, what we're trying to say is that citizenship is a good, and that it's important to share this good with all those who are affected by political power or by economic structures within particular countries. And so since citizenship is a kind of vehicle of empowerment, it's important for migrants to also have access to citizenship. On the other hand, we are talking about citizenship in a liberal democracy. So, and here the emphasis should be on the liberal part of liberal democracy. And so it's clear that the state by itself is not going to respond to all the kind of radical challenges that we pose, and that it's not that just because migrants have citizenship doesn't mean that they will actually be effectively empowered, just like the fact that we have the power to vote doesn't mean that all our votes are the same, that some people's votes are more important than others, or some the way in which we discuss or we conduct debates around elections or around, so the political debate itself is not vulnerable to these asymmetries of power that we find within liberal democracies. So on the one hand, it's a question of being of showing that citizenship is a good, but on the other hand, also showing the limitations of a particular way of understanding citizenship, the category of citizenship, and to, in a way, also pointing to an alternative vision for how citizenship could be if we really did have equal power to participate in this democratic structure. So we want to show that yes, there is democracy. Yes, there are ways in which one can mobilize and one can affect political debate and also make a difference. But it's also important to show that they are limited. And this is a difficult position to maintain.
It's one of the things I like when reading your work is a constant sense of that doubleness, right? And actually an awareness that it's often very difficult, right? And it's one of the problems I think facing the Labour Party in Britain at the moment is that, you know, if you have a political strategy that faces in both directions, you still get pulled in one particular one, right? And actually maintaining that is often quite hard.
Yeah, and what is also often very important, I think, is to show that it's not because particular individuals are ill-willed. Mm. It's not that particular individuals don't have the right values or don't want to do things in a certain way when they get sort of co-opted by these processes of, you know, bureaucratization. Of think about social democracy, the way in which social democracy gets co-opted by the liberal state. It's not because any particular person, I mean, of course, there are margins even there of interpretation, and there is discretion. There is obviously individual discretion, but it's also important not to describe the process as the failure of, you know, Tony Blair or of Gerhard Schröder, or of to see that there's sort of structural factors in play that make certain developments more plausible at a particular point in time, given all other things and given all the other constraints. I mean, think about, you know, when I think about New Labour, of course, now we blame Blair and we blame Schröder for the failures of New Labour, but it's also important to realize that this was the result of the end of the Cold War, mm-hmm. and that this was a particular a balance of forces that was emerging out of a consensus that there really was no alternative. And so the question was, you know, the working class is dead, class struggle is dead. we only have to think about values and how do we then construct a discourse around values that is not, that is different, but that enables us to do some of the things that we've always done. So that's where I think we perhaps need to be more charitable in understanding these developments and in reading them, not just, as I say, not just as the failures of the will of the particular individuals that are happen to be at that point in time. In
right, I mean, it also suggests that you can't go back, right? And this is one of the things I think that afflicts politics on the left in particular, is like, if we'd only not taken that right turn then, and we can just sort of, you know, put history into reverse gear and then go the other way. That doesn't seem to me to be plausible. Yeah, I mean, look, it's a vice that we all fall into. I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also, as I say, it's important not to, I mean, of course there is discretion. Of course there were, in 1989, there were alternative paths not taken. There was a possibility of saying, yes, we always knew the Soviet Union had problems. You know, de-Stalinization happened in 1956. Nobody woke up realizing that, you know, there's all been these horrible things going on in the East. But there was also a way in which, even in Eastern Europe, some of the kind of struggles for emancipation against communism weren't necessarily struggles to have capitalism instead. They were internal. A lot of them came out of internal debate amongst intellectuals looking for alternatives and trying to chart a kind of alternative democratic path that was anti-bureaucratic socialism as much as it was anti-capitalist. And that whole project, I think, has been lost, and that is one of the paths not taken, for example.
There is one of the people, I think there's too little of his work sort of translated into English really, but Gaspar Miklós Tamás, who's a Hungarian thinker who sort of emerged from sort of classic state socialism, becomes in the 90s sort of becomes enamored with the sort of liberalism, you know, the advent of capitalism, market solutions, and has this sort of very interesting sort of boomerang back towards a libertarian socialism when encountering the phase that he made there. So it's this incredibly interesting account where he talks about, you know, refusing the kind of easy answers that they adopted in the 90s, and they always knew to some extent were not true, and kind of mourning in some way some of the things that were lost in that process. And I think that's a really kind of striking and very kind of fine-grained appreciation. I want to talk about some of the historical antecedents of the European Union, and in particular kind of 18th century work on perpetual peace, which I know you've worked on, I know you're interested in. And these are this kind of series of projects or series of, you know, pieces of writing or pieces of thinking, which are born out of kind of political strife, and which look at, you know, which are claimed, I think, often by you know, European intellectuals as forerunners of the European Union. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about where those projects came from and whether that's a real claim, whether that claim makes sense.
Well, so they are born in a way similar to the European Union, out of the fear of war and the kind of the conflicts of war. Kant's Perpetual Peace starts with this sentence, perpetual peace, that which he claims to have seen in a Dutch inn, where the sentence was affixed to a painting which showed a cemetery. And so Kant's ironic remark was that perpetual peace is the peace of death. It's a peace of the cemetery. So, and the idea is that war brings conflicts, and the conflict is death, and death both for the states and for the citizens of these states who participate in this war. So it came out of a sort of 17th, 18th century wars among European states, and later the discourse was developed because of imperial competition and the wars, that the fact that these conflicts continued often with regard to access to resources in other parts of the world. So that's a very interesting question. So what is the sort of the philosophical commonality in a way? The idea is that we have, why do we have the state? We have the state because we have conflict, we have a state of nature, and we need a kind of political authority to which all those who are in the state of nature need to subject in order to be made free from this kind of conflict and to for the creation of order and peace. And then these thinkers who kind of mobilize around this project of perpetual peace, like the Abbé de Saint-Pierre was the first to start, and then Rousseau comments on the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, and then Kant continues the debate, and then Fichte has a very interesting criticism of these projects, which if I have time I'll say something about. But what is the shape of the debate is to say, well, we have states of nature and we have a solution via juridical authority, via the state. But then we have states who are in conflict with each other, and we have war in the international sphere. So we have something like the state of nature in the international order, and we need an authority that is similar to the authority of the state that can contain these conflicts. And that's where we need, Kant says, not just a treaty, because a treaty is puts an end to war with some limitations for a time. We need perpetual peace. We need a kind of common juridical order and common juridical relations amongst states that that can contain this conflict. And in the 18th century, this came along with a discussion around commercial relations and the idea that commercial relations were also important factors of kind of socialization. And so it was not in the interest of states really to fight, since commerce requires peace and peace requires juridical relations. Now, what is really interesting about this 17th, 18th century debate is that people who criticized then the projects of perpetual peace like Fichte criticized it in the name of going back to an analysis of the relationship between the state and commercial relations that says actually no, trade and commerce are the reasons states enter into wars with each other. And so Fichte, for example, in his defense of the closed commercial state, says, well, if the state wants to satisfy the claims of its citizens, to give them, to grant the rights that we recognize as part of sort of democratical democracy, democratic sovereignty, in a way in which Rousseau, for example, said, if the state wants to do that, the state needs to tax citizens. In order to tax citizens, it needs money. Where does it get money? It enters into conflict with other states for access to resources in other parts of the world. And so we have this idea that imperial war and conflicts are not, they result from these commercial conflicts between states. And so the idea that commerce will put an end to conflicts between states is actually stopped in these criticisms of this sort of 18th century. It's very interesting. I always think of Fichte as one of the kind of early Lexiteers. You know, he has this real defense of a closed commercial state. We need more planning. We need fiscal autonomy. The states will never going to get anything done with regard to their citizens if they don't cut themselves out entirely from this kind of order of states that cooperate with each other, but then also enter into commercial relations. So in a way, so in all these projects, I think we find a lot of the debates that we now go on about, you know, what is the force? Does commerce have a kind of civilizing force, or is it a disruptive force? And
so the 18th century is just an excellent predictor of our current problems. Well, 19th, I suppose, in the last case. I guess like one of the things when I think about these I was looking at the Kant text the other night, actually, and as you say, I mean, I do like that kind of, you know, double reasoning, right? So you have the state of nature, and then you have actually relations between states, which just repeat actually the same form. But there's something I guess quite careful about the way Kant talks about it. Is like he's very concerned about whether there's sovereign authority here, actually, and it seems to me that the issue gets skirted a bit in his account of it, but it seems to me there's a recognition that actually you get, because the first thing he says is like, actually the ideal here would be a global state, right? He says, look, you're on a limited planet, right? You can go so far and then you start coming towards each other again, so actually you can't, you know, escape, you know, in any kind of infinite sense, right? So you're on a, you know, terraqueous globe, you're limited here, so fundamentally political thinking has to take account of the fact that you are part of a community of people. And so therefore the best way to deal with this would be to have a complete global planetary state, single authority, single unitary, but that's not going to happen, right? And I think that's really interesting, right? Because you have this sort of very, you know, in some ways kind of very classic form of reasoning, right? So towards this kind of ideal political project. And then like empirical reality sort of collides with it and it says, okay, well, this is clearly not going to happen. It might happen, you know, one day in a very, very distant future. It's not going to happen. So what we need then is this kind of federated state, or this federated entity. It's very careful to say it's not, you know, it's not a state. And that sovereign states retain, you know, autonomy, et cetera, whatever. Do we get this sense here that there are these kind of very difficult questions which have gone on, you know, unanswered for a good couple of hundred years about exactly what, you know, how, you know, you know, the empirical reality of a limited globe, the existence of international globalized commercial networks, you know, the fact that that, you know, states have these wars, you know, all come, you know, all sort of t- tumbles over the question of sovereignty. And so is there a sense in which the sovereignty is the question that, that really troubles all of these projects?
Yeah, and partly because I think sovereignty is a proxy for capturing a whole series of processes and practices that are seen as in some ways valuable. So it's not, I think, that the criticism that Kant makes to the idea of the global state is that he sees a disanalogy precisely because between the way in which individuals come together to overcome the state of nature and the way in which states come together to overcome the state of nature. And he says, and the disanalogy is that states have already created some form of right. So we're not dealing here with the exact equivalent of the individuals in the state of nature. Why in the state of nature there is no sense of what law is, no sense of public right? When you have states, you have juridical relations and historical practices that contribute to shaping these juridical relations that are significant and that we can't override. So I think this is where it becomes a question not just of the empirical feasibility of a global state, but there is a kind of ethical objection to the fact that what we need is a form of spontaneous association, one that can't be imposed on states. And of course, Kant, being the kind of Enlightenment optimist and Republican, radical Republican that he was, he thought that if you had Republicanism, then states would really have no reason to fight with each other. And because of this kind of the critique of commercial relations, although it was there, it was not as developed in Kant as it was, say, in someone like Fichte. Kant was more optimistic with regard to the question of, well, if we have republics everywhere, then these republics will come together and they will cooperate spontaneously and they won't need to fight each other. Whereas what Fichte and other authors, obviously Hegel and Marx, later show is that, well, in fact, there is something that goes beyond the state. There is something like a global market. There's commercial relations that are in competition with juridical authority. And this is where the answer becomes fight capitalism. If you want to transform the state, you need to fight capitalism. And if you don't deal with the problem of capitalism, then you can go around in circles with how you're going to reform the state. But all of these projects of federation, of republican alignment, and so on, are ultimately going to fail because they haven't resolved the fundamental conflict. And I think this is where Fichte begins the discussion around this, but obviously Hegel and then Marx and other authors develop it a lot more. And that's where I also think where it's really important to see the kind of the legacy of the Enlightenment in socialist thinking. We often think of socialism as, you know, as a kind of critic of the Enlightenment, or as the socialist tradition as emerging in opposition from the Enlightenment. But I think a lot of the sources that enable us to understand Marx are actually in these thinkers of the Enlightenment, which shouldn't be left to the liberal tradition to appropriate.
It strikes me the other thing that's there, kind of in embryo in Kant, is this. This sense, and I mean, it connects, and we don't want to get too deeply into it, but it connects obviously with this kind of idea of freedom. So obviously, you know, for the possibility of a promise or the possibility of a contract, the capacity to break it must exist. But he also reserves the capacity to act with force on any kind of delinquent nation which seeks to kind of break its contract. And that seems to me to be so, you know, in some ways, to be so. Clearly an anticipation of Greece that it's actually really, really quite alarming. I mean, I was reading it and thinking, well, this is the Troika in Greece, right? Like, I mean, you know, not exactly. But it does seem to me that is obviously there in some ways, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But what is also there, I think, is a kind of the critical resources to question this foundation of the modern state on property theory, for example, because one of the things that is really interesting in a number of these authors is that on the one hand, the authority of the state is clearly, you know, it begins with contract. Everything begins with contract and with property. But on the other hand, someone like Kant always emphasizes that until we have a form of right that recognizes and distributes property in an equal way to all those who are subjected to this authority, every form of property will actually be provisional. So this is where the difference is between, say, Kant and someone like Locke, who says, you know, we have the state so that the state can protect property. And Kant says, no, we have the state so that we can know what is mine and yours. And the further resource and critique for kind of liberal for socialist thinking is to say that Kant also emphasizes that this doesn't have to be done just at the domestic level, but it requires a kind of global interaction. So it's, we don't really know what is right, what property is right, until we have a kind of juridical relations at a global level that enable us to distinguish between different forms of right and to think about property in a kind of global way. So I think this is where it's extremely powerful and where one can mobilize, again, this kind of juridical way of thinking about property in an anti-liberal tradition, at least anti-liberal as conceived as a defense of current liberal property rights, for example.
Let's talk about Just something else that emerges from the 18th century and that you've also so worked on, you co-wrote a book about it, in fact, which is partisanship. So and this is such a live question again at the moment, right? Because it's often pointed to as it's the poison in our politics, right? It's that there are these intransigent partisans on both sides of the debate and they're ruining everything. And it just struck me that there's that sort of very interesting claim that Carl Schmitt makes about the emergence of the partisan at the end of the Napoleonic Wars being this sort of horrifying thing, right? This is a guy who fights because he believes in something, not because he's motivated to do so by obligation to his state, right? He's not part of an army. He's like a fighting idea. And this becomes, and this kind of horror is repeated in various forms of conservatism, actually, over the past few decades. I guess we should begin there then. Is partisanship a poison?
No, not in itself. So the answer that we give in the book with Jonathan White is that it's not a poison in itself, but it can be a poison in particular institutional circumstances, and it's because of the circumstances rather than because of partisanship. So if you think about the tradition in which the thought around political parties and partisanship emerges, and this idea that a party is different from a faction. This is really important. A faction is an interest group that mobilizes its supporters in defense of a cause that advances their own interest. And the idea is that a party is a political agent that advances the common good, that advances in the name of principles that aren't just about you and your mates and you or your fellow partisans, but that ideally advances the kind of the good of the entire political community, or that is done in the name of principles that can be shared by others as well. This is a crucial distinction when we think about how parties at their best should be. Now, it may well be that under capitalist conditions, capitalist circumstances, all parties are factions, or most parties are factions, because of the way in which interests condition politics and political process. But I think it's also very important to think about the ideal of what a party is in order to be able to think about political processes and the contribution that these agents, who actually believe in a common good but may have different interpretations of, what is the common good, how we get there, and so on, make to the political process, to the democratic process. So if we believe in democracy, then we also think that there's disagreements, that people have reasonable disagreements amongst themselves, and they need agents who enable them to channel these disagreements in the right way, not in a kind of unilateral or partial way or self-interested way. And that's where the difference is between a party and a faction. Now, as I say, in current political circumstances, this is where I was emphasizing that the problem may be with the circumstances rather than with partisanship as such. In current political circumstances, it may well be that the funding of parties, or the way in which campaign finance in the United States poisons the political process, makes it very difficult for these agents to act like the ideal of the party and end up behaving like factions and are like factions. But I think it's really important to kind of keep in mind how would partisan exchange be if it were done in the way in which a party promises to do it, which is to kind of articulate these interests and principles and claims in a way that is impartial and tries to advance the good of the entire political community.
I mean, I suppose the really cynical deployment of this stuff, it always strikes me, it becomes... So the accusation, obviously, in the press is always towards, and it's almost always towards left-wing writers they're partisan, and therefore their partisanship degrades their capacity to reason. Right, so they are incapable of actually articulating the truth, and are moved to all sorts of kind of unethical behaviour, lying, propaganda, whatever. And it strikes me that this is so common a claim now in contemporary political discourse that it's almost unavoidable. And it's a claim that in some ways can be quite tempting to make. And sometimes you see things where you think this reasoning must be warped by something. I often see it when I'm reading people on the right and think there's some kind of motivation here that's kind of underneath it. But to then kind of discount the possibility of public reason at all, it seems to me to be the kind of very dangerous situation that we've entered into.
Yeah, and not only is it dangerous, but I think it's also a partisan act itself in a bad sense of the term, in the kind of in the derogatory way in which the critics use this term, because it's it's presenting a particular view of the world as this was the right way of thinking about the world, and anything that departs from it as a departure or as a kind of deviation or as, you know, a polarized view that we shouldn't take seriously. And so there it's kind of grounded on this idea that what I, the critic, am articulating is the truth, and you cannot contest this. And all the people who contest this or who act in such a way as to challenge this received wisdom are just extremists or, you know, pathological partisans. And I think that's where it becomes, that's the risk is that we don't actually see the partial nature of that discourse. I don't want to use partisan because, as I say, I tend to use the term partisan as a kind of, in this kind of normatively rich ideal way. But the kind of the factional nature of this discourse, which is to say, well, it's only my perspective that is the right one, and anything that departs from that is. And I think this is a good way of capturing centrism, actually, often in politics. I mean, centrists often present themselves as being, you know, compromising and over the parts and trying to negotiate and so on. But then when you realize that the position comes with its own substantive commitments, you realize that that is also one particular take on the political world, and that... And that's, democracy works when that take is challenged.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's really, you know, there's something that emerges actually from that book, is this kind of sense of the, you know, the agonism is positive. Again, that word has its own kind of political ramifications, theoretical ramifications. I do think, and I was reading your chapter on compromise last night, and again, it has that kind of, you know, sense of double obligation, obligation to the political process, obligation to the party, you know, itself, obligation to ideals, obligations to you know, the constituent parts of the party. You just wonder if are there theoretical resources that can tell us something about, just in our political moment, whether there's a kind of compromise that's useful?
Yeah, I would say a compromise that's useful is one that doesn't entirely sacrifice the identity of the partisans who are part of this compromise. So I think there is a way of thinking about compromise is to think about certain choices that need to be made, because there are processes in which we have to engage and the responsibilities that we ought to carry. And these are responsibilities that we carry not just towards, say, if you think about MPs, for example, the responsibilities of MPs are not just responsibilities to their to the partisans that contributed to their election and campaigned for them and so on, but also to their constituents, to people who profoundly disagree with them. And these responsibilities, once the MPs are in office, ought to be carried forward. So the question there is, how much should an MP, there can be a trade-off between the demands of partisans, of the people who voted you, and the demands of constituents, and that there can be a requirement of compromise under such circumstances. So what is a good way of making compromises? I think if we value partisanship, as I think we should, because we value democratic exchange and we value the idea that it's important when visions are put forward and people can challenge them and bring their best arguments, and it's in a way this exchange that develops and enables both of the interlocutors to develop. If we value partisanship and we also value this kind of collective identities that parties also nurture and that bring forward, then it's important to acknowledge that parties have to make compromises, but it's also important to acknowledge that these compromises shouldn't sacrifice their identity as partisans, that we make compromises up to the point in which we don't entirely destroy our identity as a partisan. And because there is a kind of a trade-off between loyalty to the ideas and to the vision that make me the partisan that I am, and that make me campaign for this set of ideas rather than this other set of ideas, that something that I believe in, and I believe in with other people, and I also have responsibilities to the people that I represent or with whom I interact to also represent their ideas. So there is a kind of responsibility of loyalty, of partisan loyalty, that has to be balanced with the responsibility to compromise. And I think it's important not to lose the kind of the partisan nature of the compromise, not to lose sight of the partisan nature of the compromise, and not to sacrifice one's identity for the sake of just the constituents or this, because ultimately I think that ends up in the long term weakening partisanship and also weakening the sources that we have to make these democratic debates meaningful and these exchanges productive.
Final question for you. I know that you're a political optimist, right? I think there's a Kantian commitment there. It used to be reasonably easy to predict the direction of British politics, right? It operated within like a very kind of constrained space. It doesn't seem to me to be so easy anymore. What sense do you have of the kind of best possible trajectory for British politics?
Okay, I'm not going to make a prediction because A, academics are not good with predictions. And B, I think these days, even when academics were good with predictions, making predictions is about as reliable as going with a horoscope. So, but there is somewhere where Marx says, you know, he discusses at some point prophetic history in the Enlightenment, this idea of, or what was called conjectural history. So the idea that there is a kind of philosophical development in history, that there is a kind of sense of purpose that individuals collectively develop and so on. And there was a whole debate around, well, what is this? What kind of predictions can we make? Can we say that, you know, history is moving forward? Can there be progress? Can, what grounds do we have for being optimistic? And this was, as I say, a big debate in the Enlightenment. And at some point, Marx picks up on these debates. I can't remember where exactly, but he says, he engages with the idea of prophetic history. And he says, well, prophetic history is legitimate if the prophet makes the events that they prophesize, if they contribute to kind of shaping the world that they are anticipating. So I'm optimistic because I have a kind of political, a set of political commitments, and I kind of try to act on the basis of these political commitments and to kind of advance these political commitments. And insofar as I'm just stating what my political commitments will be, that's a kind of prediction, right? So I'll just say what I hope to happen. What I hope to happen is that Brexit will not come to dominate political debate in this very insubstantial way in which it has dominated it for the last 2 years, in without, you know, with few exceptions, without really any meaningful discussion around what is the EU, what is the nature of the EU, what kind of goals does it serve, what kind of projects does it enable, in a way that kind of deprives this partisanship that we were talking about, of the kind of epistemic resources that it needs to advance and to develop the democratic debate. And I'm hoping that a kind of radical social democratic agenda like the one that, you know, the Labour Party is currently advancing, which I don't think is actually that radical. I mean, it seems like, you know, I know people are going on and on about, you know, Corbyn and so on, but it's a sorry sight of the state of affairs in which we're in that this seems like it's an extremely radical agenda. But so hopefully the idea is that these kind of social democratic reforms, if there is a range of these reforms in a range of countries, like hopefully in the United States with the Sanders or Warren presidential coming election and so, if there are a number of these progressive developments, hopefully the quality of discourse will begin to change. Mm-hmm. And since I think one of the greatest legacies of the neoliberal and Thatcher-Reagan era has actually been ideological, it's just this inability to think about a future beyond capitalism and to think about alternatives to liberalism. My hope is that the kind of the long work that the Ruse of Reason will do in this process of social democratic reforms will be to actually enable us to think beyond the current limitations that we have and to kind of think about bigger, bolder, transformative visions and to enable us to actually begin to even ask the questions of what kind of society do we want to have, what kind of democracy do we want to have, and what kind of world do we want to live in.
That's it for this week. My thanks to Leah for joining me. Do pop on over and keep your eye on Navarra Media over this weekend. And of course, we will be back on Resonance at the same time, in the same place next week. Bye-bye.
This show is brought to you by Navarra Media. To find articles, videos, and more audio content like this, head to navarramedia.com. If you particularly enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen to it, why not head to iTunes? And as well as subscribing, leave us a review. Navarra Media can only exist thanks to subscribers and supporters. If you have the means, please consider subscribing at support.navarramedia.com. As well as helping us continue to produce regular content, subscribers will also receive priority access to events as well as promotions throughout the year. For regular updates, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Navarra Media. Media for a different politics.